Hi, my name is Juliette, and I'm the host for this podcast. I will be ordained as a rabbi in a few months. And I want to tell you that in Judaism, there's a specific portion or reading from the Torah, the Hebrew Bible, for every week of the year. And as we go through these readings week by week in order, from the beginning of the Torah to the end, from the beginning of the Jewish year to the end, we analyze the stories and we comment on them. Of course, connecting them to real life, to contemporary life, is how these ancient stories come alive, which is one of my great passions as a future rabbi. I hope you'll accompany me as I tell these stories of Torah and of my life and the lives of others. And if you miss an episode, you can always go back and find it wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for coming with me on this ancient and contemporary journey with me. Thanks for coming with me. I just repeated, with me. Please visit my website, lenegditamid.us, lenegditamid.us. And you can always make a donation, much appreciated and very necessary. Any amount appreciated. And check out all the other things that I offer. So on today's podcast, we're going to talk about jade and joy. Why jade? Being jaded. And whether we find joy in not just the ordinary, but the unordinary, the things that we should find awe and joy in, but we don't. This week I had, well, actually it was last week. I was without my phone for a week, almost a week. I got locked out. Is that crazy or what? I mean, what would you do if you were locked out of your phone? Yeah, my daughter tried to change the password for me. She was being helpful, you know, and I was like, yeah, Poppy should be able to get into my phone and he can't memorize passcodes, you know, he just doesn't know anybody else's number. And I was like, what if there were an emergency and he needed to get into my phone? So I got locked out because something went wrong. And, you know, security and iPhones and blah, blah, blah. Funny story. So I couldn't record last week, but I'm here now and I'm going to be recording twice this week. So last week, I had the most amazing experience. Actually, it did extend into this week because I got to go to a second bris. So last week, I went to a bris on Wednesday, all the way out in Brooklyn. And the very next day, I went to a funeral home to have a tour. So both of these things are part of assignments that I have as I'm finishing rabbinical school. And I'm in a life cycle class, for an intensive life cycle class. So I had to do these things to accompany a moil and to also accompany a mortician. So I got to see the two ends of life back to back. And that was a really, that was a really interesting experience all by itself, to just one day see birth, new life, brand new life, and the very next day to experience death. Well, I didn't experience it exactly, but to be in that environment. And they were vastly different experiences, yet I felt like they should have been the same in one way. And this is what I started out talking about. I felt like they should have both been filled with awe. But the moil, he was jaded. He's been doing it for a really long time, for 30 years. He's a rabbi. He's coming to retirement age. He does it for a living. He believes in it. He's committed to it. But I got the feeling that he was jaded. And it really upset me. He was just distant and showed absolutely no interest in the baby. Like, he didn't even ask to see the baby. When the couple came in, we were at someone's private home, and he didn't ask about the baby. And it was all business. And he gave a nice ceremony. He said all the right words. He used his rabbi skills, you know, but I just felt like there was this not only distance and cutting off of his emotions, but also a kind of frustration and an arrogance and an arrogance even towards the family. And it was upsetting to me. And it was, it's like, if you're going to do this work, you know, yes, of course you're going to you have to cut off your feelings to a certain extent. You're putting an infant 8 days old in a lot of pain, and it's really hard to watch. But that wasn't the part that upset me most. It was the Moyles' attitude. And during part of the, another thing that happened during the ceremony and during the ritual was there was this woman, an older woman, maybe around my age. I'm almost 60. She was maybe 65 or something like that. She wasn't so old. And she was on her phone the whole time, scrolling, 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 tapping, 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 scrolling, 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 while the rabbi was talking, while everything was happening. Even before the baby was circumcised, even after the circumcision was over, she was still on her phone. And it made me think of also, as I was coming, I was going all the way out to Brooklyn without a phone, right? I had my phone with me, but I couldn't use it because I was locked out. And I was surrounded by all these people on their phones, and nobody looks up. Hardly anybody ever looks up. They sit down, they're managing their coffee and their book and their coffee and their, you know, their, yeah, whatever it is, and their phone all at the same time. They can't help themselves. And there's all this amazing life around them. And part of it is upsetting, part of the life that's around. You see homeless people sleeping on the subway. You know, right in the car where you are, there's a man sprawled out across one entire bench. The train was pretty empty. I was going very far out to Brooklyn. So it's like part of it you don't want to see, but then again, it just reminded me as a child and a young person growing up before we had all these phones. Even into my 50s, even into my 40s, people weren't carrying around phones the way they are now, disconnected from everything that's going on around them. And people are so interesting to watch. You know, this is the life that's around us and the buildings that we pass by, and there's always something new. So here I was with a woman looking at her phone during this very important ritual. And I understand maybe she needed to cut herself off, just like the rabbi needed to cut himself off to an extent. But it felt more like an addiction for her, and to him, it felt like, how about finding the balance between your commitment to doing this, your belief in it as an important ritual in Judaism, and also your awe for life, and somehow not forget that you are serving human beings here. So that was what happened there. And then, and the other thing, the family surprised me also. They were so similar to mine. I had no idea who this family was before I got there, but it was like the future. This was a positive thing. This was really cool. It was like the future of Judaism and the present. It was a mixed marriage, quote unquote, mixed marriage, a Latina woman, Mexican. I assume that she converted to Judaism. She teaches in a Jewish school. She's dark-skinned. I don't think she was born Jewish. Her mother and sister were there. And then the father of the baby was a child of Holocaust survivors and a Middle East Sephardi mother. So very interesting family. And this baby looked native to Mexico with this full head of thick, straight black hair shooting out and dark skin. And that was a pleasant surprise. That was the opposite of what, you know, of the other thing that I experienced, the other things that I experienced that were negative. And it was such a pleasant surprise beyond my little world, where my family is mixed. My husband is from Ecuador. My children are Jews of color. At least one of them considers herself that. I'm not sure how the other one would identify, except that, you know, my dad is Ecuadorian. My mom is Jewish. I'm Jewish. That's what she says. And she's getting married in the fall, and they're having a Jewish wedding. Even though her husband was brought up Catholic, he has a grandfather that was Jewish. He connects with it in some deep way, and they want a Jewish wedding, and that's also to me really beautiful. Even though he's not converting officially yet, but they don't want an interfaith wedding. And that's a whole complicated thing in itself, like what the wording is, but that's another story. Anyway, so back to now onto the funeral home. Not having seen the awe that this Moyle expressed for this new life, I saw the opposite in the funeral home the next day. I got the most amazing mortician to tour me around, to talk to me. We talked about the soul. We talked about the process of dying. We talked about her training. We talked about Jewish beliefs around death and dying and what happens to the soul. It was the most beautiful conversation. She held death and the human body in such awe and what happens to it. And this was exactly what I expected to get the day before, but instead I got it on this end. And I'm not saying that all the morticians, this was a large funeral home with 10 funeral directors, and they weren't all Jewish and they weren't all excited about death. One of them, I talked to him briefly and he said, yeah, it pays the bills. He wasn't so excited about it. And that was more like what I would have expected of people being jaded around death instead of around life. And yet I got the opposite. So I was wondering, it got me thinking how in our wider culture, we have lost our sense of awe at the mystery of everything. And we've numbed ourselves. We numb ourselves to that is within us and that's all around us. Partly by staring at our phones constantly. That's the numbing process. Part of the numbing process. And I ask, would the world be different if we lived with more awareness, being more aware of that which is around us and aware of ourselves, our bodies, our emotions. And if we could hold death with the same reverence we hold new life, that we hope that we hold new life, if we're not jaded, right? And if we didn't approach the end with such fear and turning away and denial, if we could both hold pain and joy at the same time. And then I was thinking about this week's Parsha, last week, in which so much arises. Beha'alotecha. The people are finally setting out through the desert. A cloud settles over as an indication to stay put. God settles this cloud over them. It's like, now you don't move. And then he lifts the cloud when it's time to move on. For all these people to move on to a different part of the desert. And no one has a problem with these two states. These are two states, just like life and death, right? We have the cloud is there and the cloud is gone. Nobody complains about it. What's hard for the people is the redundancy of eating the unimaginable miracle, this unimaginable miracle of manna day after day. I mean, here's a miracle, but it's the same day after day. And instead, they remember, quote unquote, remember, because I can't imagine how they had access to this as slaves, but they remember the abundance of meat and fish in Egypt and they complain about it. And they, oh, if only we had, and I remember when we had, you know, and God becomes frustrated and sends them quail and meat, showing that nothing is too much for the Almighty. Because Moses says to him, how am I going to serve, what is it, 60,000 people? How can you possibly make enough food for all of these people? But of course, God shows that it's not too much for him, and he even says so. And then he punishes them after making them, having, you know, supplying them with all this food. And then he punishes them for their cravings and complaining by sending a plague upon them. And another thing that God shows is that Moses, though a prophet and special as a prophet, God shows that anyone can become a prophet. And in fact, Moses wishes it were so. And when there's an incident where a child, a boy, I think it's a young man or whatever, comes and complains, says, somebody, so-and-so is acting he's acting the prophet. And Moses is like, so? That's good. Other people should be able to talk to God. I shouldn't have to be the only one. And so when I think about my experiences of last week with the Moyle and the funeral home and of lack of awe in our culture, I think of the state of the world and the constant barrage of bad news. And I think surely there are good things happening. And can we hold both? Can we hold both the bad and the good? Because we don't get any of it in the news. Can we hold life and death? Can we hold being tired of the manna, of the redundancy day after day, and also our craving for delicious food? Can we be in awe of this miracle called manna, but also say, oh, but it's okay. I also can have these cravings for good food. I'm grateful for this food that I have, even though it's boring. And I also wish I had something different. And just like the people don't make a fuss about the cloud. This cloud, I think of this cloud settling down as this cloud that we are living in today of things are clouded. We're not seeing clearly. We're staring at our phones. We're not seeing and perceiving and living with ourselves in awareness. So what if we could take all the bad, the cravings and the, you know, and not get angry about it, right? The way God gets angry with the people. What if in the darkness of the clouds that we're living under, we could also say, oh, but look at all the joy in the world. Look at all the beauty in the world. Can't we hold both? And I wonder, can we possibly change the way things are going in our world if we can't hold everything? It almost feels like we should be able to. We should try. Because can we, if everything is negative, how can we change? Can God, Moses, and the people hold everything as well as they do the cloud settling and lifting? The gratitude for freedom and enough food versus the boredom of manna. I know I'm repeating myself, but it feels important. The ability of more than one, of many people to become prophets and communicate in their own way with the divine. And I was wondering, how can a sense of belonging in and among all, our sense that all belongs, birth and death included, and a reverence for the cycle of life and our love for the life that exists, how can that help us in our work? And I found part of the answer in a conversation between marine biologist Ayana Elizabeth Johnson. I don't know if you've heard of her, but you can listen to this interview with Krista Tippett on Being. It's about, Johnson talks about her future book, What If We Get This Right? She's a marine biologist. She's talking about the climate. She's talking about saving our planet, saving humanity, saving life, all life. And I'm going to read you the description of what of this interview. It says, amidst all of the perspectives and arguments around our ecological future, this much is true. We are not in the natural world. We are part of it. The next generation marine biologist, Ayana Elizabeth Johnson, would let that reality of belonging show us the way forward. She loves the ocean, She loves human beings, and she's animated by questions emerging from these loves and from the science she does, which we scarcely know how to take seriously amidst so much demoralizing, bad ecological news. My prayer for this week comes in the form of a question that guides Johnson. I ask, could we let ourselves be led by what we already know how to do and by what we have it in us to save? That's her question. What, she asks, if we get this right? What if we get this right? And that's a we. She stresses, if people say, what do you mean by you get this right? No, you're missing the point. What if we get this right? So my blessing is, may we find peace with the clouds lifting and settling, the dark times and the light times. May we let ourselves be led by what we already know, by the love and the awe and the pain, and by a sense of belonging for life and all its stages. May we be and become leaders in our own special way. And may we know that nothing is too much for us to achieve. And let us put our phones away and notice the awesome variety of life around us, as painful as it may be sometimes. May it be so. Ken yihi ratzon, and amen. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here with me. Talk to you soon.